Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... I got the charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink?
This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera.
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn on what you want, like trying out that new workout class, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like a foam roller for your sore muscles. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
Hello, I'm Peter King. Welcome to the MMQB podcast with Peter King, where I take you inside the minds of the biggest influencers in the NFL. This week, Green Bay Packers coach Mike McCarthy, who's overseeing a big comeback by the Pack this year. And also, Armin Katayan, lead correspondent for 60 Minute Sports, contributing correspondent for 60 Minutes, and also one of the writers on a great new documentary about Lawrence Phillips, the troubled former NFL player. I asked McCarthy, how did you fix Aaron Rodgers this year?
I think it was more of the changes in how we were playing. I think I put, frankly, maybe too much on his plate, and it's easy to do with Aaron because cerebrally he's unique.
And I asked Katayan, why is Lawrence Phillips, who played two decades ago, still relevant today?
Well, Peter, I think it's relevant because it's really about far more than Lawrence Phillips, and it's about far more than football. It's about domestic violence and domestic abuse in this country, and it's not so much about what happened to Lawrence Phillips, though we delve deep into that, but more importantly, it's about why what happened to Lawrence Phillips and what Lawrence Phillips did to the women that he abused.
And now my conversation with the coach of the Green Bay Packers, who, by the way, has been the coach of the Pack longer than any other coach in Green Bay history, other than Curly Lambeau, Mike McCarthy. In the bowels of Lambeau Field in Green Bay with Mike McCarthy, the coach of the Packers. And Mike, I really appreciate you joining me. And I want to talk a little bit today about the coaching business and about your job and about your team. But I want to start by asking you, this is one of the most hallowed franchises in all of sports. And you have been the coach of this team longer than anyone except Curly Lambeau. When I say that, how does that make you feel?
Well, it's an honor to coach here. I think all of us feel that way. And it's really part of the culture that's been established here in Green Bay. And not only are we so appreciative of the culture we have today, but of the history, you know, and the tradition of the Green Bay Packers. So, yeah, it's gone fast. It doesn't seem like year 11, but it's a special place. I'm just thrilled to keep maximizing it. And on another note, I think it's really a reflection of my coaching staff and the people I work with. I mean, we have a veteran coaching staff. You know, the program that Ted Thompson and I have built here, you know, it speaks for itself. So, but yeah, longevity is tough to accomplish in this league. So I think any time there's a mention of Green Bay Packers history, it's a compliment. So anytime you accomplish something, and I know we make a big deal of it with our players, you know, if there's a record or anything is established and it's part of Green Bay history, it's special.
As somebody who grew up in such a football-crazed area in western Pennsylvania, loving the Pittsburgh Steelers and knowing what they meant, does it mean something to you to coach for one of the really great flagship franchises of the league? I'm not saying there's nothing wrong with coaching the Tennessee Titans or the Jacksonville Jaguars, but the Green Bay Packers, that's just different.
Definitely. I think as a young kid growing up in Pittsburgh, that's what you know. But, you know, obviously my youth was the 70s when they turned a corner and had the great run with the four Super Bowl championships there, and the Pirates won two World Series and Pitt won a national championship. So that's kind of what you know, you expect. And with it, I think it gives you ambition to go on to do things, to dream and chase those dreams. But, you know, once again, Peter, as you know, you've been covering the National Football League forever. It's a privilege to coach in this league. And the fact that you are the head coach of the Green Bay Packers, I mean, that's something that I take very serious on a daily basis. And I know when I pull into Lambeau Field each and every day, and then when I leave Lambeau Field, it's a special place, and I don't take it for granted. And I think it's a big part of my motivation to do best by the organization.
So, Mike, as we sit here today, it looks like you've got the makings of your winter beard going, and you just came in from coaching your team in practice, 25 degrees today. You're probably hoping that you have some of those cold days when teams come into Lambeau Field the rest of this year, but how big of an advantage do you think, if at all, is it that you practice in this weather, and then in the month of December, and for your sake, hopefully January, you're able to play some games here?
I would say it's an advantage because I think it's no different than going to the South. You know, I know the first game in Jacksonville this year, I mean, that was a huge challenge for our football team.
Because it was so humid?
Oh, yeah, over 100 heat index. And, you know, and it probably helped us because it was closer to summer and some of our players are from the South and so forth. But I think when you do go in an uncommon environment, the advantage is to the home team. But, you know, we have such a great tradition and history here in Lambeau being, you know, such a marquee place to perform, it kind of works against us a little bit too. I think other teams look forward to playing here, and that's all part of it too. So, but I think if you can practice and train in an environment and then also compete in that environment, you would hope it gives you an advantage.
With Green Bay coach Mike McCarthy on the MMQB podcast with Peter King. So, Mike, you had some real adversity this year as a team. You had your first four-game losing streak since 2008. That's a long time in the NFL to never lose four games in a row. How did you handle that with your team? And also, how did you handle it personally?
Well, I would just go to consistency. I mean, that's all I know. You know, this you can't change. I mean, you're the leader. You're in front of the room each and every day. We're a young football team, so I really focus a lot of my messaging to our young players because it's important to make sure that the expectations are clear for them each and every day. Our veterans, frankly, have been outstanding. I've said repeatedly that this team is clearly one of the best group of just men to coach as far as the energy and the focus that they give every day. But, you know, we've had a lot of challenges, and that's – every year you have different challenges. It's, you know, whether it's injuries and so forth. But, I think when you have injuries that attack at one position, you know, to have your running back position depleted and our corners have gone through that too, our inside linebackers, you just keep working. And these guys never really blinked. And we had some games where we had some opportunities and didn't get it done. But I never really dwelled on the four-game losing streak. It was always about improving. I think you just – those times are when you really have to focus on what's good. I talk to my football team a lot about counter intuition. You know, and the fact of the matter is, you know, when everything looks bad, you have to focus on the good. And it's no different when we've had a lot of success here. And I've always told these teams that the hardest thing they'll ever have to handle here in Green Bay is handling success, because when you are successful as a Green Bay Packer, you know, there's a lot of good things happen for you. So I think the fact of the matter is when things are going really good, you got to make sure you stay on top of your weaknesses and no different when we're going through that stretch. We just had to stay focused on the positives of our football team, and I think it's pulled us through.
What'd you say to your team after the Washington game, where is your fourth loss in a row, and really you were not very competitive defensively in that game? You played very well, I thought, offensively. But you kind of got overrun on defense, in part because of injuries, obviously. But what did you say to your team both after that game, and you're flying home from that game, and what are you thinking about as a coach, and how are you thinking you're going to get out of this?
Well, I mean, as I look at you and your high-tech operation here on the road, it makes me think of the plane ride. You know, you're able to pretty much watch all three phases by the time you land. So
you watched the game on the way back to Green Bay?
Yes, I mean, yeah. It's kind of a common practice. We all have iPads, and they're loaded up, and you're able to watch it. And really, I think you have to just stick to the old, you know, theory that sometimes it's not as good as it looks, and sometimes it's not as bad. And you know, the Washington game was we knew we're going to have some challenges there, and they hit us with a couple of plays. Frankly, we had guys out of position that created big plays at the wrong time in the fourth quarter. So that doesn't make it any easier because that was clutch time because it was a back-and-forth football game until that point. So just really, once again, just stay in touch with the good things that we did in that game and focus on the things that we needed to correct. Because, I mean, there's times where earlier games, you know, my tone and my message was totally different. But, you know,
in what way?
You know, I don't say negative, frankly, just right. I felt we needed to push harder and do things. But at that point, that was more, you know, it wasn't about effort. It was really a breakdown in execution. So and with that, you have to keep playing to your strengths. And I think we've done a better job of that since then. So I think we're clearly going to be a better football team because of the adversity we went through, because just the way they work. I can only go by what I see every day. I can only go by what I see at practice. I mean, when you practice at 4 o'clock under the lights, it's a neat experience. But it was cold out there today, and our guys they just fly around like it's week one. So that says a lot about your team. I've been to this point in December where we've been very successful. Where the team was tired, you know, or you have a little more up and down in your energy. You know, you got so much information now, like GPS and mm-hmm. so many different things to confirm or you know, how you think a practice went. And I just can't tell you enough about just the way this group works. Now, we have a lot of work to do. We're not where we want to be, but I clearly feel that we can get there just because of the commitment these guys have.
So, Mike, you know, you watch Aaron Rodgers. In some ways, it's kind of been a tale of two seasons with him. He struggled some, obviously, in midseason. I thought his mechanics at points in that losing streak and at other points in the year looked off to me in terms of not necessarily using sort of the classic Aaron Rodgers posture and throwing motion. But I just wonder about you personally and your relationship with Rodgers. How did you get him out of it? How did you get him out of whatever little funk he might have been in during the course of this year?
Well, I mean, in regards to his funk, I really don't agree with you on the fundamental evaluation there. I think really it was a matter of what we were doing, you know, as an offense. You know, we came into the season tilted more towards more no huddle than standard, and that's really the way we went last year. And after the second game, you know, in Minnesota, we made a change. So we went back to some, you know, standard, we call it standard huddle operation, getting more people involved. Frankly, the injuries were already starting to happen. So it was apparent that we were going to be playing younger than we thought we would be. So especially when we lost Jared Cook there in a Detroit game. And so we kind of made a shift there. And frankly, it was a shift for him as much as it was for the other players. So we did have some games where, you know, we weren't as clean as we wanted to be. But I don't know exactly what game it was, but I think he's been Aaron Rodgers that we all know and love from whatever point that was there. I think it was more of the changes in how we were playing. You know, I think I put a lot, frankly, maybe too much on his plate, and it's easy to do with Aaron because cerebrally he's unique. I mean, that way it's he's beyond coach smart and his application. I think, you know, you always look for quarterbacks that can take it out of the classroom and implement it to the practice field, and then obviously to Sunday. I think that's a tremendous trait that he has. So we're in our groove now. We're playing the way we want to play. You know, we had that, you know, no huddle, a standard huddle shift. That was one thing. Then we had the no running back, right, two or three phase there too. So we worked.
But I really
that.
Liked. So, you know what I like. I like you putting Montgomery back there.
Oh, absolutely.
Because he's such a versatile guy. Mm-hmm. You know, he's such a different player. And you know what I've noticed too the last couple of weeks. I mean, he can block, and he's a willing blocker too.
Absolutely. I mean, he's a 225-pound man. I mean, he's a strong young man, and he just needed time to develop. So we were working on it earlier in the year, him trying to be I wanted to get him into the game, get him opportunity. That was another reason to get away from the no huddle, because you get into just playing with the same personnel group as much as you can, and you're not using, you know, the Ty Montgomerys and some of the other players. So that was part of our reasoning of getting away from just being strictly no huddle. So he's a good running back, and he's definitely a matchup issue when he comes out of the backfield.
Finishing up with Mike McCarthy of the Green Bay Packers. So, Mike, two last things, totally 180 degrees different. I wonder, how do you deal now with this sort of instant public criticism that kind of borders on condemnation of your job? I mean, I think everybody is feeling it in almost every walk of public life. You know, the criticism that you get. I mean, if you wanted to say that Vince Lombardi was a bum, you had to sit down and write him a letter. Or you had to pick up the phone, and he's not going to answer your phone call. But with you, it takes about 10 seconds on social media. McCarthy's a bum. So how do you handle all of that and just the sort of access that people have to your players via social media and, quite frankly, to you, even though I doubt you're very concerned with that?
Well, I'll say this. It's taught myself and not in our organization a lot. I think it's definitely taught us two things. The importance of messaging, you know, beyond just our football team, and maybe doing a, you know, better job messaging to our fans. And the other part of it is the importance of social media. I mean, I can't really complain about what people think or say or do in social media because – I'm a non-participant, so I mean, it's,
you're probably glad about that, aren't
you?
Yeah,
I like the Coach Lombardi's way. I'd be all for the letter writing process if we ever want to go back to that. But so if you're not a participant, or it's in as an organization, you really are not out there. So you can't argue when the message isn't going your way. So we've been fortunate that we've had success where. That hasn't been a priority as far as I know, my focus or, you know, the focus of, you know, our football team, you know, as far as being out there. I mean, I know we have our players are out there on an individual basis and so forth. So I think it's lessons well learned.
Last question for you. This is totally – I've been asking a bunch of people this because of the little bit of controversy over Thursday night football.
Okay.
And I'll never forget, this was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, you were going to play Detroit on a Thursday. And I asked you this question. I said, so how do you feel about playing on Thanksgiving? And you said, I kind of like it. And I think our players like it because they get the mini bye afterwards. So I'd ask you as we close up, what do you think of Thursday night football? And do you believe that there are both disadvantages and advantages to it?
Well, just like you finished there, I think it's two questions. I think Thursday night football has – I understand why we do it as a league. But also, like every coach and all the players, you understand the challenges of it too. So, and it's really tough on the players. I mean, the coaches, you make it work, you do what you have to do, but it is very difficult on the players. And I think everybody recognizes that. The other part, you know, I think what your first point is, we've played in a Thanksgiving game probably 4 or 5 times in my career here. And I did like it because it came late in the season, week 11 or whatever, when it hits. But you also want to have your bye week at, you know, week 5 or 6,
right.
Because like this year we had our bye week at week 3 and we had a Thursday night game at like week 7. And that, frankly, this is the hardest schedule we've ever had here, just for the way it's laid out, because, you know, since that Thursday night game, we've been on a, you know, straight, you know, playing every week, and, you know, Sunday night, Monday night game in there also. So I think the timing, the coordination of the Thursday night game coordinated with your bye week is very important. That's a very important combination if we're going to continue to go that way. But that's one issue.
But late in the year, do you like having the 3 or 4 days after that game?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if it's necessary, I would definitely like it later in the year, bye week early in the year, or vice versa. Just one or the other, because it is like a mini bye week. And you have to find those blocks. I mean, scheduling is such a big part of the head coach's job more and more each and every year. I mean, look at these injuries. I mean, you know, what's the answer? So, I mean, what's the solution? So I know I spend a lot of time on that. I mean, there's always conversation, research, and, you know, you look at the innovation in the field of rest and recovery and nutrition. And
do you have a lot of your guys do that ART where you put all those needles in players?
It's going on right now as we're doing the podcast.
No, is that right?
No, absolutely. There's resources out there, and I think you have to make them available the best you can to your football team. And then, you know, there's also outsourcing that goes on, and I think that's consistent with every NFL team.
Mike McCarthy, really appreciate you joining me on the podcast. Thanks. Good luck the rest of the way.
Thank you, Peter. Great seeing you.
Thank you.
It's the MMQB Podcast.
This is Adrian Wojnarowski of The Vertical. For candid conversations with the biggest names around the NBA, be sure to check out our podcast network, which includes The Vertical Podcast with Woj, The Vertical Podcast with J.J. Redick, and The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, all at thevertical.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, everybody, listen up. You don't want to miss this. Make sure you remember these four letters, MMQB. Listen, with the holidays here, the post office is packed with everyone mailing holiday gifts and cards. You need to use Stamps.com instead. With Stamps.com, you can avoid the hassle of going to the post office during the busy holiday season. Anything you can do at the post office, you can do right from your desk with Stamps.com. Buy and print U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com simply doesn't close. You can get postage whenever you need it, 24/7. Now here's the part I told you to remember. Right now, for my listeners, sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code MMQB for this special offer. A 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Within minutes, you'll be printing postage right from your desk. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in MMQB. Don't forget the microphone at the top of the screen. That's Stamps.com, and enter MMQB.
Back on the podcast, the MMQB podcast with Peter King. My guest this week, actually we have a couple of guests here in the CBS studios high above 57th Street in Manhattan. I'm with Armin Katayan, longtime colleague, former SI writer, now has made a life for himself in television. So I'm here with Armin Katayan, and we're also here today with Al Briganti. And I'll explain to you what exactly we're going to do on this segment here as we sit in the CBS / 60 Minutes offices in New York City. So I've known Armin for quite a while, and he reached out to me a couple of weeks ago, and he said, Peter, I'm involved with this great new documentary. It's called Lawrence Phillips Running for His Life. It's going to be on Showtime in a couple of weeks. And would you do me a favor? Could you please just take a look at it? So I saw it was 90 minutes long. And I said, Armin, I'll watch at least 15 minutes. Tell me what I should watch. And he said, watch the beginning of the show. And I said, okay, I will. So finally, this past Sunday, getting ready for week 14, the Sunday games in the NFL, I turned on the documentary maybe at about 11:45, and I started watching it, and it was one of those things I could not turn it off. I simply could not turn it off. We'll get to some of the details, but Armin, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, it's a big deal for me.
Well, it's a big deal for me, too. Well, thank you. First of all, I want to ask you about Lawrence Phillips. He's a guy who had a meteoric career in the NFL. His career 2 decades ago, his career was ruined by alcoholism and domestic violence. Domestic violence that is so heinous and so over the top that, honestly, Armin, when I finished watching this documentary, and I believe me, I am anti-capital punishment. I am give everybody a chance, you know, don't throw anybody in society away. But when I finished watching this documentary, I said to myself, I'm not sad that this guy is not on this planet anymore, because I believe that at some point in his life that Lawrence Phillips was probably going to kill somebody if he ever got out of jail again. So, Armin, I would just ask you this question. Why do you believe that Lawrence Phillips is still relevant today?
Well, that was one of the things that we struggled with in the beginning, was to try to figure out why someone like Lawrence Phillips would resonate today. And the answer came fairly quickly. Domestic violence is a huge issue in college. It's a huge issue in life. Lawrence's story, as you mentioned, his meteoric rise as a running back, a lot of people knew him as an athlete. Others had known him for what had happened at Nebraska in the incident with Kate McEwen. But there were parts of his life that, as we did our reporting, that very, very few people knew about. And we thought that that played into a much bigger picture about athletes and domestic violence. The narrative oftentimes is very simple and naive. You know, they're thugs. They come out of the inner city. They don't know any better. And Lawrence just cut completely against that in several ways. Yes, he came out of the inner city. Yes, he had a troubled childhood. But he was also a very gifted person intellectually. And that led us to the idea of looking deeper into his life. And when we found out about the group home situation and what had happened with his mother being abandoned by his dad, the life that he had when he was 5 years old in L.A., not attending fifth grade, missing the entire grade. And then it took us to the group home, McLaren Homes in Los Angeles. And that's where the story really changed for us. It became, I think Lawrence Phillips is a metaphor in a lot of ways for what happens with domestic violence and athletes. And what we were trying to do, and I know we were trying to do, was to tell a bigger story, not what happened so much with Lawrence Phillips, but why it happened.
Armin, you have done a lot of stories and a lot of investigations in your life. You did so many great things at Sports Illustrated, and now you've worked not only for 60 Minutes Sports, but also doing stories for 60 Minutes, which is just the hallmark of television journalism. This story, to me, when I first saw that you had been involved in, I said, well, I'm going to have to pay attention to this. There's got to be some good stuff in it. But also, Lars Anderson, who has written extensively on Lawrence Phillips, and who did such a great job writing about Lawrence Phillips around the time of his death, who now works for Bleacher Report. Lars Anderson, I thought, was so interesting in the depth of knowledge that he had about Lawrence Phillips, including what happened to him when he was young. And I'm not going to ask you to tell me 15 stories from the documentary, but there's three things that I must ask about. And I'm going to have Al tell the story. I'm going to have you actually pass the microphone over to Al.
I can do that.
In a moment, because I do want to ask about the worst abuse of all. But I was blown away by the level of reporting and the level of abuse that Lawrence Phillips took from his mother, both in physical, mental abuse, never saying I love you, things like that, but also the abuse from some of the boyfriends in her life. And I'll just preface all this by saying this. It's very easy to say, as you just mentioned, that guy's a bum, forget him, inner city thug, everything like that. But what made this so great is that you went and found out why this happened. What happened to this kid? He lived in a car in fifth grade in Los Angeles. He never went to class in fifth grade. He just missed fifth grade. But if you can, tell the story about what happened to Lawrence Phillips and his mother when the boyfriends even got into some of the abuse.
Well, let me just back up for a second, because you used a word that we're sitting here in the 60 Minutes offices on the ninth floor in the 555 building in New York. There's a single word that defines and has defined this broadcast for 49 years. It's reporting. And I think that's what distinguishes this documentary from many, many, many others that I've seen. There's a level of reporting. There's a level of detail. There's a level of insight that comes from not only the interviews, but it comes from the writing and everything. So that imbues the entire documentary with a level of intelligence and a level of, I think, integrity to the documentary that a lot of them don't have. But when we discovered, and you mentioned Lars, and without Lars, this documentary doesn't reach the level that it is at. The level of detail and the level of understanding of Lawrence. Because when Lars came in, he brought an innate understanding of Nebraska football, which I had done a book about the program, but Lars lived it growing up. And he had been around Lawrence during his early days at Nebraska. So we had this kind of spine to the story through not only Lars being in the documentary, but in being a co-writer of the documentary. But one of the most harrowing things was, you know, when Lawrence moves to LA, he's 5 years old. They're running away from a life in Arkansas, and the mother just has a string of bad news boyfriends that show up at the house, one more abusive verbally or physically than the next. And the one situation that is just so traumatic is one of the boyfriends at one point in time holds Lawrence down on the floor. He's very young and urinates all over him. I mean, I don't know how you deal with that as a child. I mean, that you're beneath contempt for somebody. And that was the life that Lawrence had to escape. And there was really nowhere to go. I mean, you look at what was going on in L.A. in the 80s, the late 80s, it was a urban warfare, Bloods and Crips. The streets were dangerous, and Lawrence was out on those streets. And there's no question, the anger and the violence and the animosity and the abandonment that he felt was reflected in his relationships with women till the day he died. And that's what makes this story so different, I think, than some of the other documentaries you see that skirt around these issues or avoid these issues. Thanks to Ross and to Al and to Lars, we just went straight into it and we tried to get as deep as we could. And then the writing and Steve LeMay, who was the photographer, Jason Schmidt, who was the editor. These are rock star guys that I haven't worked with anybody that I would put in front of either one of those two guys. And then having Al, who really was the captain of the ship for us and kept us on track and kept the narrative tight and allowed us, Lars and himself and myself, to write the kind of doc that we were looking for. You know, these things, Peter, I live in a world of collaboration, as you do. And without the collaboration of this group with Ross's vision and everything else that fell in underneath that, you don't get what you get with this. These don't come around very often. And it was an incredible honor, really, to be a part of something like this because I was surrounded by people that are nothing but the best of the best.
Lawrence Phillips, Running for His Life, debuts on Friday, December 16, on Showtime, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Ross Greenberg, director and executive producer. Armin Katayan, executive producer. Al Briganti, producer. Written by Armin Katayan, Lars Anderson, Al Briganti. So I must sort of fast forward this and talk about the reason why I do this podcast is to talk about NFL stuff. And so as I watch this, you know, and I had a very unique view of part of this because when Dick Vermeil went back to the St. Louis Rams his first year, I followed him for that first year back in football and wrote a very long, I don't know, maybe 12-page story at the end of the season that basically was a diary of his season. And I will never forget one of the things in his life, in Phillips's life, that took place during this year is that Kevin Warren, who was then a vice president with the Rams, Lawrence Phillips still had to do some community service. And he had to take Lawrence Phillips to the morgue in St. Louis. And Lawrence Phillips basically had to do some community service work in that morgue. And so he saw there was a reason why they wanted him to do the community service because they were basically telling him, dude, this could be you. And it did turn out to be him in fairly short order. But they wanted to try. Dick Vermeil was such a Father Flanagan that he tried everything with this guy. He tried being nice to him. He tried hugging him, tried yelling at him. You know, he tried doing all of this stuff with him. But
the one thing that really stuck out in this, covering the NFL now, is that when Dick Vermeil eventually fired him, he called two of his friends in the business.
Yeah.
He called Jimmy Johnson, and Jimmy Johnson brought him to Miami for a very short term. That didn't work out. He went to NFL Europe, and then he got him another shot with the San Francisco 49ers with his friend Bill Walsh. And what I'm thinking to myself, and again, I don't mean this to be as dire as it sounds, but it's almost like, hey, we got a problem child here. Let's just pass him through this class and give him to whatever, some nice teacher in seventh grade, even though he didn't pass sixth grade and he's a huge problem. Let's just pass him through. And you give him to your buddy, you know, says, hey, you handle it now. It's your turn. Because there's no program in the NFL at that time. No program for people who commit domestic violence. And so he can just go wherever because nobody in the NFL is going to say anything.
It was amazing. I think it was more guys like Vermeil and Tom Osborne being in love with Lawrence in a lot of ways. Not only his talent, but he had this smile.
He was an engaging guy, no question about it.
He was a very engaging guy.
And he was smart.
He was very smart. And when somebody like Dick Vermeil, who wears his emotions on his sleeve, calls up Jimmy Johnson and says, look, trust me, this is a kid who can be good. I mean, Lawrence is walking the plank at that point in time. You know, he's about ready to go off the edge, but Vermeil's trying to bring him back. He throws him a lifeline with Jimmy Johnson in Miami, and then he reaches out to his old friend, who you mentioned is sort of was the Father Flanagan of the West Coast, bringing players in like Charles Haley and people like that who had not fit into other places. But it was kind of the home for wayward players on the NFL side of things. But as Steve Young said in the documentary, by that time, Lawrence had lost his love for the game. You know, if you're not a professional,
right,
you're not showing up on time, you're not doing the right things, and it cost Steve, though Steve graciously would not point the finger at Lawrence, it cost Steve his career.
So explain what happened to Steve Young.
Yeah, Steve Young, it was his last play of Steve Young's career. Lawrence was supposed to go left. He went right on a block, you know, missed the assignment, blew the assignment. Aeneas Williams,
Hall of Fame corner. Blew up Steve Young.
Blew
and you
up
know what?
Steve Young.
I'll tell you one thing about this documentary that's so interesting. The video you have is absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah.
Going back to high school games in California.
Yeah.
And then at Nebraska and everything. I mean,
can I pass this to Al?
Please.
Because he sat in the edit room with Jason and saw all this stuff. So I'm going to give him his
all
moment.
All right, Al, take that. And let me just preface by just asking you, Al, if you could just talk about sort of the process of finding so much of this video, not necessarily the hit on Steve Young, because NFL video wouldn't be that hard, but what about all the other video?
Well, part of it is going to a Los Angeles garage and going through boxes that hadn't been opened in 20 years.
But what garage?
It was a guy who ran a local cable TV show, and he had tape from the coaches. Now, what the coaches had was video. It would have been better if it had been 10 years earlier and the material was on film. Ironically, that's true.
Wow.
Because it was dub of a dub of a dub on videotape. It was almost impossible.
You had videotape, for instance, of Lawrence Phillips describing why he went to one high school versus another.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And even at that age, 17 years old, he's talking about, well, they won and I want to go to a winner, that kind of thing. It was an interesting insight into this kid. One of the things I wanted to mention to you is that when we first started this project, our working assumption was that the system let him down. That the system let Lawrence down. And I think what we discovered through his high school coaches, through Tom Osborne, Dick Vermeil, one after another of these guys stayed with him and tried to help him. And they still
right, at some point, you know, that's a great point, Al, because I believe at some point, don't you have to be responsible for yourself?
Yes. And a teammate said, Lawrence always said it's on me. One of the prosecutors said he just may have had such an irreversible mental problem that he could not help himself. Now, we never wanted to remove personal responsibility from this equation. That was another fight or argument or concern that we have as we were putting this together.
Al,
would we make him a hero, and would we absolve him from his personal responsibility?
No. You know, one of the reasons, you always have a feeling about somebody at the end of, look, if you watch 90 minutes about somebody's life, you're going to have a feeling about him one way or the other. And my feeling was he had every chance in the world. He blew it, and I'm not going to listen to anybody who watches this and says, I blame the mom. I mean, sure, you're a product of your environment. I get it. But at some point, you have to rise up and you have to say, this happened to me, and if I'm going to let that determine the fate of the rest of my life, that's fine. But I just simply don't buy it. He had enough opportunities and enough people in his life who cared about him to fix his life. I understand why he got there, but I'm not buying at all after watching this that he's a victim of something. He was a victim at one point, but he had so much opportunity to fix himself, and he didn't do it.
Can I ask you a question,
Peter? Yeah.
One of the things that really impressed us, I remember Lawrence Phillips, we all did, okay?
Right.
I don't remember how great he was.
I know. The amazing thing, watching him in high school, that's the classic man among boys. He looked like Gale Sayers when he got to the Chicago Bears that you see on the old NFL films. It's unbelievable how talented he was. And even when he got to the NFL, he was very talented. I agree with you.
And that was the incredible thing, going through hours and hours of game footage and trying to find the most appropriate game footage that we could use. But what we really wanted to show was his incredible diversity as a runner. The ability he had to evade tacklers, to also just run over people, which was absolutely amazing. And he was able to do that in high school.
It's the MMQB Podcast.
Hi, boys and girls. It's Tony Kornheiser reminding you to subscribe and listen to my daily podcast, where we talk about everything from sports to politics to the impending animal revolution. And remember, you can listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play.
Hey, everyone. The holidays are here, and what's better for a loved one than flowers? The Bouqs Company delivers to all 50 states. They offer products with next-day and same-day delivery. And Bouqs offers free delivery on weekdays when you register at Bouqs.com. Bouqs could not be simpler. Simple ordering, no gimmicks, no hidden fees, and no secret additional care and handling fees either. Bouqs is farm fresh. What does that mean? Well, it means their flowers are cut fresh and sourced from sustainable, eco-friendly farms. It also means that your flowers will last longer, so your money goes a longer way. Love farm-to-table food? Well, you're going to love farm-to-table flowers. Don't forget the happiness guarantee with Bouqs. They stand behind their product and experience. If they make a mistake, they'll make up for it. Nothing makes them happier than happy customers. Now here's the best part. Go to Bouqs.com/Peter and you'll get $15 off your order of $60 or more. That's 25% off. So go to Bouqs, Bouqs.com/Peter. You'll be glad you did.
So for those wondering, I mean, because I've never quite had a dual guest like this before, but we're doing it this way because Armin explained on this documentary, Lawrence Phillips Running for His Life, which debuts on Showtime on Friday, December 16, then will be available on Showtime Go, is that right?
Showtime On Demand.
Showtime On Demand, excuse me.
It'll probably run for 6 to 8 weeks and in various time periods.
Right. But anyway, my reason for wanting to ask you one more thing, Al, is that I really feel like the most emotional I got watching this show was the last girlfriend he abused, mm-hmm. who he found in a strip club in San Diego. And you watch her now and you watch her explain how their relationship devolved. And it's so incredibly emotional and frightening that I'd like you to explain Lawrence Phillips' relationship with this woman and what happened.
Well, this was at least the fifth time that Lawrence was involved in a serious altercation with a woman. And interestingly enough, Peter, it almost always happened after the woman wanted to break off the relationship. Now, you don't have to be Sigmund Freud to figure out where that comes from, okay? Mm-hmm. But Emilia Weisler is such a heroic figure in our show, I think, that she agreed to talk to us. And she agreed to represent, I think, the victims of abuse in that...
Not just for Lawrence Phillips. All victims of abuse in the world. She is a metaphor for every woman who is abused by a boyfriend or husband, I think. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
I think she stood up for herself at the end and did bring charges against him. It was very difficult for her because I think to this day she loves Lawrence Phillips. And part of that also, when we were putting this together, colored our vision of how we were going to tell this story because Lawrence Phillips did horrible things, but there were many people who loved him deeply. And it was part of this crazy life and mysterious makeup of him that he had these contradictions that were there. He was an incredibly violent man, and at least two women were choked to unconsciousness by him. There was a victim up in Canada who he choked, and he said, "Now you'll see the real Lawrence Phillips." It was an amazing thing for us to deal with, but I think what we would talk about in our as we were putting this together and trying to figure editorially what the direction of the program was going to be, is that this was going to be a psychological autopsy. We talk a lot about violence in sports, what motivates these people to do it. Usually it's because they're coddled or whatever the reason is, or they're too dumb to understand what they're doing and their success. None of this applies to Lawrence Phillips.
After Lawrence Phillips choked this woman in San Diego, you interviewed the San Diego County prosecutor. What did she tell you about the seriousness of this incident?
Actually, Armin did that interview, if I could just pass.
Here we go. All right, Armin. Armin, what did Nicole Rooney tell you about the seriousness of this incident?
Well, what she said is that the marks on Emily Weisler's neck and the strangulation attempt by Lawrence Phillips, it was the worst strangulation she had ever seen in her life. And this was a career domestic violence prosecutor in a victim that lived. So Lawrence choked Amalia to width, you know, to
within
breath.
Inches of her death.
Right.
Yeah.
And what she, and you mentioned that, her in that closet talking to the 911 operator, and then Lawrence coming back a few days later to the apartment, and this dangerous dance, as we called it, between the victim and the abuser. You're absolutely right. It stood out to me in writing it and to Al when, in the editing and everything with Jason, as a metaphor for what women who get involved with these men, this love-hate relationship that they have with them. That's a very, very powerful moment in this film that really has very little to do with Lawrence Phillips or Amalia Weisler in the big picture, but it resonates to so many millions of women, I'm sure, across the country.
So, Armin, let's extrapolate from this. What can Roger Goodell, what can Lisa Friel, the NFL investigator, chief investigator, really, into domestic violence cases involving NFL players, what can they learn by watching this documentary?
Well, I hope they watch it, first of all, and I think they'd be fools not to watch it because it speaks to them directly. That's a difficult question, Peter, because so much of this, as we see in Lawrence, and you reported on this for 30-plus years, the root causes do not start in the NFL. They do not start in college. They do not start often in high school. They start in homes, and they often start in single-family homes. Sometimes they start on the streets. They start in schools, public schools, where kids are marooned or abandoned by their parents. And that's another level of this story is that, and I think it was so well told by the child advocate in the end, who himself was in in the McLaren homes, is that there are millions of kids, and there's so many kids out there, that this isn't really a story about one individual. if you don't educate, and I know when you get to the NFL, your focus is far, far, far from domestic violence issues because the careers are so short and the celebrity is so great and the trappings and the temptations are there in so many different ways. But I think, having been around Ray Rice after his domestic violence and domestic assault and what he learned from it, I would use people like Ray Rice. I would use people that have been through it and have learned from it to speak to athletes on their level, because I don't think a rookie symposium and a skit by somebody is going to really resonate at this point in time.
And it's certainly true of Lawrence. Alcohol, the connection between alcohol and abuse and alcohol and anger management is very, very important and is something that probably should be addressed by the NFL.
Armin, two other points, one about this and one about football, because you covered football and did the sidelines for CBS for so long. If you were going to advise a team what the most important thing that the team can do involving domestic violence is, and trying to both identify it and to address it with their players, what do you think you'd tell them?
I've seen Brenda Tracy, who was assaulted at Oregon State by, I believe, four football players, talk about her experience. I would bring in a woman who has been on the other side of this and what their lives are like. I did a 27-minute and 31-second piece about what happened at Baylor for 60 Minutes Sports in the month of November. You can't report a story like that and talk to the victims and listen to the trauma that they still endure years and years and years after the abuse. And when you have universities that turn your back on those women, as in some ways NFL teams have turned their back on those women, I would bring those women in to talk to these players to say, you know what, this is what my life was like after one bad night with a guy like you, or more than one of you, because I was silly enough to get drunk in a bar, and this is what it cost me. I think you have to personalize it, Peter, because you're not going to do it in a clinical setting,
right,
or some sort of PowerPoint, you know, presentation.
Mm-hmm. That's really good advice. So my last question, the MMQB podcast with Peter King for Armin Katayan, the executive producer of Lawrence Phillips Running for His Life, has nothing to do with this. But I'm curious about your take on Bill Belichick. And there's no easy segue from domestic violence to, as long as I've got you on the podcast,
yeah,
I do want to ask you this one question about Bill Belichick. You were around the Patriots a lot for, what, 7 or 8 years?
8 years on
eight,
the sidelines.
8 years on the sidelines.
Probably did 25
production meetings. Yeah, production
Patriots
meetings.
Games.
And, you know, you're on the sidelines. So there's a lot you can't report on the sidelines, but there's a lot that you see. So in those 25 or so production meetings, those 8 years, those being on the sidelines in Foxborough and elsewhere, what is it about Bill Belichick that differentiates him from all the rest?
Well, he's one of the smartest people I've ever been around in my life on any number of levels. I've been reading these stories recently about what the Patriots potential assistants have to go through in order to be hired by the Patriots. It's just classic Belichick. I think with Bill, for me, the word boiled down to trust. If Bill trusts you, which is really interesting with him, he watches how you work. And if you work with integrity and you do what you say you're going to do, if you don't say A and do B, because you're not going to get it a second time with him. I remember him coming up to me before an AFC championship game. This was about 6 years into it. And he said, "Hey, Armin, how'd you like to listen to my halftime speech to the team?" I'm like, "Well, yeah, that sounds pretty good." And he trusted me to take what he was saying to his team in the locker room. I was listening outside the door. I was there with Berge and Jerry and his, you know, right-hand man. And then I reported what I thought was a fair representation of what Bill had said to his team.
And how was he? How was his tone with his team?
Very, very businesslike. Some of the defensive coaches, like Romeo, was not so businesslike.
Mm-hmm. Romeo
but Bill
Purnell,
was very clinical. You know, this is what we need to do. This is what we're not doing. I think for me and all the people I've been around in the NFL and in college football, Nick Saban and Bill Belichick are the two most interesting people I've run across because, A, they want to be great in everything they do. B, they're a lot funnier in person than they are in everyday life. And that's one of the things I loved about Bill is I've been around him in personal situations, and he's really funny. He's not making jokes.
Can I give you my droll Belichick
story?
Yeah,
that's exactly what it is.
Okay, so
one-liners.
In 2004, Sports Illustrated, I really wanted to do this. I said, I want to do the definitive Belichick profile. I want to spend time with him. So I called him and basically said, can we just talk off the record? I need you to give me 20 people in your life who I have to talk to. And so we ran down a bunch of people, and at the end of it, and I said, at one point during the conversation, I said, you know, it's my goal that I want to see your football library, you know, because he had the most volumes of any person in the world on
I've seen
pro
it.
Football books.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I went through this whole process and went down to his childhood home, his dad, who was still alive at the time, and his mom, and actually stood in Bill Belichick's boyhood room. You know, saw that there was still 1984 on the bookshelf in his room. And anyway, what was really interesting is that the last day I was going to be reporting on the story, he said, why don't you follow me? We'll go to my house. Because he had said, we're not going to my house. Mm-hmm. So on the last day, he said, follow me, we'll go to my house. So I said, okay. We went to his house, and I stood there, and I looked at all his books, which are now at the U.S. Naval Academy. That's where he has
That's
them.
Right.
So that people can go in and look at all of his books. I mean, it's a very generous thing that he did in letting the U.S. Naval Academy house the Belichick collection in their library. So I was looking at all the books, and, you know, they go from the 1930s.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazing.
The Paul Brown story.
Yeah.
Remember, you know, all those crazy things.
So, I looked at one book and I said, Bill, The Art of War by Sun Tzu. Why? And he just sort of shrugged, kind of smiled. And I said, what did you learn from The Art of War that could help you in football? And he gave you one of those, like when a reporter says to him, so is Tom Brady going to keep his job now that Garoppolo has played well? You know, he gives you that look like, you idiot. But the look was, and then I said, why? What did you learn from The Art of War? And he said, don't go to war when the ground is muddy. You know, like that. And it was just, but I mean, he didn't want to say that this was a marginal book in the Belichick library, but he did want to say that I probably didn't learn all that much from it.
Yeah.
But he's a really fascinating guy.
I think he's so far ahead of everyone else. And I know in the NFL, you know this far better than I do, that it's a league of detail, and it's a league of just, you know, micromanagement of every moment. And look, he found his compadre and
Brady,
and this other guy whose uniform is on my wall, his jersey, Peyton Manning. I think they're the two, the guys that didn't want to just be great for 1 year or 10 years. They wanted to be the greatest of all time. And when you mix those with Brady and Belichick.
You know what I've always thought about Belichick, though? That he was born into the absolute perfect home. Because here's his dad, who is an assistant coach at Navy, the advanced scout for Navy, who every Sunday morning would drive from Annapolis to the airport in Baltimore and pick up the tapes on the plane that arrived from, let's say, Denver. If they were going to play Air Force the next week, they want to look at the Air Force tape. So it was sent overnight, you know, and he'd go pick it up at the airport, and he'd have that time with Bill. And then Bill would always, once he could behave, he would always be able to sit in and watch his dad talk football. So he got the football from the moment he was practically out of the womb. But as important was his mother.
Yeah.
Because his mother, who was a reader, she read every New Yorker for like 40 years, cover to cover.
Yeah.
She was one of the smartest people. I dare say she's smarter than Bill.
Yeah.
And that is saying something. But when Bill would be sitting at the dining room table to his mother getting dinner ready, oftentimes Bill would read his assignment. Let's say he had a chapter in a book to read. Bill would read it aloud, and then he and his mother would talk about what he had just read aloud.
Yeah.
I mean,
who does look, that?
Who
days?
Does that? Don't most mothers in the kitchen, don't they have the radio on or the TV on or whatever? In those days, it would probably have been the radio, but don't they have the radio on and said, hey, kid, go away. You bother me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, Jeanette Belichick was so totally into Bill, the total person. Okay, you go play sports and you be with your dad and all that stuff, but so much of Jeanette Belichick is in Bill today because it is a thirst for all knowledge.
And she edited Steve's book, which you can only imagine what those conversations were like.
Honey, what does this mean?
Yeah. Why are you changing what I wrote about, you know, the T formation? Because it makes no sense. Yeah. That's why.
Armand Katayan, with an assist from Al Briganti, I really appreciate you being on the podcast. I said I'd keep you for 20 or 25. It's 39. I hope people got something out of this. And I really, really hope that for the education of people about domestic violence and about where greatness can go astray, that people watch Lawrence Phillips Running for His Life on Showtime. Look, I'm not a Showtime employee. I barely know what Showtime is, you know. So I have no dog in the fight here. It's just that I watch this. It's fabulous, and people should watch this documentary. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
You're listening to the MMQB podcast.
So here we are with just 3 weeks left in the National Football League season. But I am here to talk this week about someone who's no longer employed in the National Football League, and that is Jeff Fisher, who was fired this week by the Los Angeles Rams as their head coach. And I think a lot of people might wonder, hey, wait a second. Jeff Fisher just agreed to a contract extension. He's got guaranteed money coming to him through the end of the 2017 season. Why'd he get the bum's rush now? Why getting fired now? Well, one of my beliefs, you know, after covering the NFL for 32 years, is when a situation becomes untenable, unworkable, and it's becoming increasingly difficult day after day for everyone in the building to go to work, then you don't really worry about what point you're at in the season. You basically say, we've got to make a change right now. And so would it have been better for the Rams to wait until the end of the season and give Jeff Fisher a gold watch and say, hey, thanks for the 5 years you spent trying to get us on track. It didn't work, but you were a good employee, a loyal guy, and we're just sorry it didn't work out. Probably would have been better. But the one thing that I believe that a lot of organizations feel is once you've absolutely decided to cut the cord, do it now. And that way, in this season, the Rams, specifically COO Kevin Demoff, who's been through a coaching search before in Tampa Bay when he worked for the Buccaneers, and also obviously with the Rams when Fisher was hired, Kevin Demoff is going to be able to get a 3-week head start on the other competition he'll have for coaches. One of those certainly will be in Jacksonville, where it would be the biggest upset on the planet if the Jaguars do not fire Gus Bradley, their head coach, at the end of the year after his 4 seasons. So Kevin Demoff, I'm sure, is going to use this time to research people like Kyle Shanahan, the offensive coordinator of the Atlanta Falcons, and Josh McDaniels, the offensive coordinator of the New England Patriots. Probably David Shaw as well, the Stanford head coach, although I do not think David Shaw is going to go anywhere for the time being. And he'll research those coaches, and I believe that, you know, the last time, you know, he had to pick a coach, he was led to Jeff Fisher, but the time before that, I think everyone was surprised that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, through the work of Demoff, picked Greg Schiano, the head coach at Rutgers. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Rams take a flyer on someone who will be very unexpected, at least at the start of the process. In my opinion, the Rams need to do one thing and one thing only. They need to get the smartest offensive mind they can find with an asterisk. And that asterisk is they need to be absolutely sure that that coach believes strongly in Jared Goff, the first pick in the draft by the Rams in 2016, who has not looked very good in his first 4 weeks. But then again, you look at a lot of quarterbacks early on in the NFL. They're thinking too much. They're not just reacting. You look at John Elway early. He had a debacle early on in Denver. Terry Bradshaw was yanked in Pittsburgh. Phil Simms was benched with the Giants. So, you know, there's no question in my mind that the coach that comes in this time with the Rams has to be a believer in Jared Goff and also really should be on the offensive side of the ball. But I'm going to give you my 1A on this new coach, whoever it is. That coach had better have a very strong-willed, strong-minded defensive coordinator in mind, if indeed they pick an offensive guy. And I'll tell you why. The Rams right now have a very good defense with some excellent defensive players. They may have the defensive player of the year in Aaron Donald on their defensive line. Alec Ogletree, I think, is going to be a star in this league. They've got a very good defense right now that on a given day can hold anybody in the league to the teens or less. So I think it's going to be really important that that coach have a very good, very strong, and a strong presence of a defensive coordinator in mind. You know, finally, I'll just say one thing. I'm not generally a fan of coaching changes, especially when it's a good man like Jeff Fisher. And I believe that Fisher is a good coach, even though he hasn't had a winning record, I think, in 8 years. I think he's a good coach. He's been in some tough places. But I also think that as an organization, if everybody in your organization isn't sort of rowing the boat in the same direction, you're in trouble. You know, what is good about New England right now? Nobody walks into that building right now who doesn't believe in Bill Belichick. What happens in Baltimore? They believe in John Harbaugh. Pittsburgh, they believe. Now, the fans all might not believe in Mike Tomlin, but the people in that building really revere Mike Tomlin. So those people, same thing in Seattle with Pete Carroll. So I think it's really important to make sure that the people who sell your tickets, the people who market your franchise, the people who sell the luxury boxes, go home at night and said, you know what, we are on the right track with Mike Tomlin, you know, or Jim Harbaugh, or Jason Garrett, or Pete Carroll, or Bill Belichick, whatever, whoever it is. So if I am the Los Angeles Rams, if I'm Stan Kroenke, the owner, if I'm Kevin Demoff, the president, when I'm interviewing a new coach, I want somebody who's, you know, can be, in a way, a cheerleader for my organization, who can walk in to the ticket office and say, guys, what do you need me to do to help? And that, I believe, is going to be a hallmark of this hire, the kind of team player and the kind of really, really bright offensive mind that the Rams feel can lead them into 2017 and beyond. Thanks to my guests, Green Bay Packers coach Mike McCarthy and the lead correspondent for 60 Minutes Sports, Armin Katayan. If you enjoyed these conversations, be sure to listen and subscribe to the other great episodes in the MMQB series, such as my conversations with Christian McCaffrey, Ben Roethlisberger, and Drew Brees. You can find these on the MMQB.com or iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Listen to the other podcasts in our series as well, with Albert Breer, Gary Gramling, and Andy Benoit. Thanks especially to the folks at Digital Media for their production work. And thanks, of course, to my sponsors, Books and Stamps.com. Please support them the way they support this podcast. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.